You're listening to Business Stories with Ryan Arcaracci, where I speak to business professionals from all walks of life. Thanks for listening, and let's get to it. Redneck Resilience is the name of the book. The author is James Webb. He is my guest today. We are here to talk about his journey into entrepreneurship and franchising, starting out as a kid from the country, working his way up and building that. So James Webb, thank you for being here.
Ryan, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's good to have you. Let's talk about, you know, your upbringing. Obviously, this book is centered around resilience from a young age. You built that. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your career.
Yeah, I'll give you the quick update. Born to two 17-year-old high school students in a small town of Laurel, Mississippi. Grew up quite poor. Learned early in life that if I wanted anything other than food on the table, I had to do it myself. So literally started working at 5 years of age, making potholders and selling them at the little local church bazaars. Got into the printing business in high school, was a printing press operator through high school. I worked full-time then and with high school. Got out of high school, went to the local junior college, of all things on a music scholarship that the choir director from the church got me. Uh-huh. And saw a sign one day that said, want to be an x-ray technologist, call this number, and I did. Was accepted to the program. As I tell people often, it was a two-year of slave labor program because you work for the hospital for 2 years. Sometimes you have classes during the daytime. You worked at nights, daytimes, and you worked the late night shift. They actually paid you $1 to be available to help out the registered x-ray technicians. Mm-hmm. So kind of did that for a while and got my x-ray tech license and then worked the night shift myself in the emergency room, went back to college in the daytime, got a bachelor's degree, was an x-ray tech in Mississippi for a few years. And then one day decided I needed something else, a master's degree, and I wanted to get into hospital administration, I thought. So I literally flipped a coin, heads I go to Dallas, tails I go to Atlanta. And 2 weeks later, I packed up a pickup truck and a bass boat and drove to Duncanville, Texas, and slept in the Redbird Mall parking lot trying to figure out what the heck I'd just done. And that's literally started my career in the Dallas market as an x-ray tech.
You talk a lot about, you know, at least your book talks a lot about resilience and how to persevere through things. And I mean, being a kid from really young parents and then working at 5 years old, how, like, what's going on in your head when you're that young? How did you develop that? Is it something that you felt like was embedded in you, or did you just develop sort of grit because you were coming from difficult circumstances?
Yeah, I had some really great role models as parents. My dad foregone a baseball scholarship to marry my mom and raise me, and then eventually my two brothers. And he started out as an electrical apprentice, and he worked his way up to a lineman, and I watched him do the 12 and 15-hour days and really had a great work ethic. My mom, a stay-at-home mom, until she decided to go back to school, and she ultimately became a nurse practitioner, so that's a master's degree plus while raising children. So I learned a lot about that drive came from my parents. And I also learned pretty quickly that we were poor, and that if I wanted that cool Stingray bicycle at Sears and Roebuck, that I had to go mow yards, make some money, and go buy it myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you had this interesting transition into the franchise world. So I'm curious how that happened. You went from the medical industry into the fitness industry. I think it was Orange Theory Fitness. And it's interesting because you see things in the medical world, and I'm wondering if maybe you thought, okay, well, I'm seeing this stuff happen in the medical world, maybe I should get into the fitness world, because it's kind of like tied together.
Yeah, no, this is a little bit longer story, but it's actually got some fun parts to it.
Okay.
So I was in the radiology management business in Dallas, got a job as a director of a department, and was literally going to go be a hospital administrator, had been interviewing for those kind of positions. And I got a call from a guy who said, hey, there's this thing called MRI coming out. This is in the 80s. And we want you to join us. And I ultimately did. And we built the second largest, at that time, mobile MRI company, where we had the MRIs inside these big trailers and moved them from hospital to hospital. Mm-hmm. And I got a really great life lesson when I'm sitting in my office. I've got about 300 employees. I'm 30 years old. I think I'm at the top of my game. And I get a phone call that says, Mr. Webb, we just sold the company. And since you have no equity, you're fired.
Wow.
And I literally learned at that moment that I was a hired gun. And that really started me down my entrepreneurial path. My first company I started in the 90s and took an MRI and heart catheterization internationally into the Caribbean first and then into Latin America. Got all sorts of crazy stories about that. And then sold that company after I started having children because I do actually dealing with some pretty dangerous stuff in some of the South American countries. And then started a company in Dallas with two buddies. I moved to Florida for this other company. I was back in Dallas. And we worked. And in 2003, I was dead broke. I had to start all over and figure things out. And we made a couple of business decisions that people said wouldn't work, and they did. And over the next 17 years, we built the largest outpatient radiology company in Texas and got pain management, built the largest pain management surgery center company in Texas. Sold all of those in 2017. And I was trying to figure out what to do next. I had had a little tragedy in my life. I lost my wife at that point. She died of a pancreatic cancer.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And I was raising two little boys on my own and decided to try Match.com because I figured the bar scene wasn't for me. And I met Kathy and we dated for about 3 years and we're in South Florida in around 2013. And someone said, "Have you ever heard of Orange Theory Fitness?" And I won't use the language, but I said, "What the blankety blank is Orange Theory Fitness?" Took the class the next day myself because I like to work out and thought the class was cool. But what caught my attention the most was the trainer. And I've used this term before. I said, "She bled orange." She was so passionate about the brand. And that's what caught my attention, her passion. So I bought three Orange Theory franchises initially for my girlfriend, then fiance, now wife. And then Orange Theory called me and said, "Hey, you're a business guy in Texas. We'd like to, you to be a little more involved." So we ended up buying a territory, most of North Texas, and put together a team and went to work. And over the next 5 years, built 33 Orange Theory fitness gyms throughout North Texas. And then in 2019, December 19th to be exact, 3 months before COVID, we sold 33 gyms to a private equity group. Had the exit plan, did not have COVID plan, and it was just a one of the luckiest breaks of my life. But it taught me a lot about the franchise world. It got me more interested in the franchise world. Didn't really want to do startups anymore by myself, and so that sort of led me into a second and then a third franchise.
So I work with a lot of consultants, and you're probably familiar with like FranChoice and IFPG and some of those groups. I'm curious from somebody who bought a franchise, why did you make that decision? Why did you pick that brand? And you said it was because of the passion too that the instructor had. But what else about the brand made you decide to do that? Where did you see the feel like there was potential there for you?
Well, again, the passion and the brand was critical. I'd met with them several times down in Florida, flew back and forth a few times, trying to make sure that what I've learned about the franchisors is, they really dictate a good bit of your success. And I like the infrastructure they had. They seemed to be very passionate. At that time was really when it started growing. They had about 95 locations, but they had probably 300 or 400 franchises sold. And so, it appeared to me to be going to be a successful brand. The fitness industry was appealing. It wasn't any passion I had. I personally work out a lot, but it just was the fact that I thought that this particular brand was going to grow, and I was right. It has grown.
And so once COVID hit, how did that, so did that really affect you much when once you were in that industry, or were you pretty much out by then?
Oh, I sold, as I mentioned, I sold December 19th of 2019, 3 months before COVID. I mean, we had the exit plan. We had an investment banking group shopping it. It was a very, very hot product at the time.
Yeah.
This boutique fitness industry was taking off. Other boutiques, things were taking off. Private equity was highly interested. We ended up with 36 offers
Wow.
and narrowed that down to one and sold it. And then had no clue COVID was going to hit. My team stayed with the deal, so I kept up with it. I still own the area rights, so I kept up with it. They took a pretty decent hit, obviously, with COVID, as did all fitness things. And talking to them yesterday, they still have not fully recovered.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
they're doing well, but not as well as we were doing.
And then you transition now, you're more involved. I think it's Centown, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that brand and what drove you to them?
Yeah, that was a fun one. After Orange Theory, we took a little break and we, did some fun stuff, bought a house in Mexico and had some fun. And then I'm not one to sit around, so we started looking at some other things. Got involved in a franchise initially called Be Balance Centers. It's a female homeopathic weight loss company. They've not done as well as we'd like, and they're kind of rearranging things and putting things in order. So we have only three of those stores. Was looking for something to do with my son-in-law. First time I'd done anything with a family member. And my wife found, as she found Orange Theory, she also found Sin Hound. Researched it, found out that the primary principal of Orange Theory was also an investor in Sin Hound. So spoke to him, flew to Florida, met with the team. An amazing infrastructure, one of the best I'd ever seen. They had about 40 stores open at the time. That was last September. They now have 60 stores open. I think they have close to 300 franchises sold.
Wow.
So once again, kind of reminded me of the Orange Theory, a very hot product. And so we negotiated, and one of the things I learned very early in life is you don't want to necessarily buy a franchise, you want to buy a territory.
Yeah.
So we ultimately bought three territories in Dallas and then have an option on two more that's exclusive for a 6-year period. So if everything goes perfect, we'll build 25 stores across the Dallas market, and probably do the same thing we did before.
Right.
Pop them all together and look for an exit strategy.
And talk to us about a little bit about the brand. You said you were drawn to it. Explain to us what they do exactly.
Yeah, it's really interesting concept because it's a whole lot different than I thought when I first looked at it. Sin Hound, and I'll give you the perfect example. It's a membership-based program. So you're getting ready to go take your Orange Theory fitness class. You go on the app, you book an appointment, you drop your dog off. We do a 5-point health check on your dog. And then we wash your dog. And then when you come back from your Orange Theory fitness class, we give you a report card. It says, here's what's going on with their skin, their nails, their teeth, their ears, other parts of the body. And we've had them washed. And then if you want some other stuff done, we offer services like grooming. We offer other services. We have products on the shelf that you can buy. And so being a dog lover, that was part of it, caught our attention. Our family, has dogs and loves dogs. And
Yeah.
we love the concept of teaching people to be a better dog parent.
Yeah.
And that caught my attention when I went to the little brand meeting they had before I bought in. They talked a lot about teaching people how to be better dog parents. And then finally, realizing that the fitness industry at the time is probably a $130 billion industry, and the pet industry is close to a $250 billion industry, projected to be a $400 billion industry in the next 10 years. So those sort of things caught my attention
Yeah.
and said, okay, this is another way to go with a business. Understand franchising pretty good, and now I'm going to learn how to wash a dog.
Yeah.
My team went through the training program and off and running.
That's interesting. And you brought up too, like infrastructure with these brands. And I'm curious, when you look at an infrastructure, what do you mean? Like, what do you foresee as a successful infrastructure for a brand?
Yeah, and particularly for a franchisor, I'm looking at the marketing, I'm looking specifically at the brand awareness. I think that was so critical for Orange Theory Fitness. That's so critical for any new franchise, is making that. What are their plans to make the brand awareness? If I say Be Balanced Centers, you don't know who that is. If I say Craig Weight Loss, you know who that is. If I say Nutrisystem, you know who that is. So really those sort of things caught my attention. How much they had put into marketing, how much they were putting into the structure. The fact they had a corporate office, the fact that they had multiple people there already, the fact that they had a little private equity behind them already, pushing them. All those things sort of added up to, okay, these guys know what they're doing. They've got the right people in place. I'm going to join them.
So let's talk a little bit about the book too. I want people to look up this book because it looks really interesting. You talk about, resiliency, investing in the people around you, recognize the need for calculated risk, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Can you give us some examples kind of those particular topics in your life of how you've applied those?
Yeah, I'm a key believer in relationships. You know, a lot of people think they can get it all done themselves, and I think relationships define your success, whether it be with your vendors, whether it be with your banking, whether it be with your employees, particularly even with your competition. Having relationships will ultimately lead to your biggest chance at success. And so I'm a huge proponent of doing that. In the case of my employees, I created an ownership structure for key members. So they actually participated in my companies with me. And one of my tiny claims to fame that I'm proud of is I had 14 employees that had employee rights in the companies. 13 made it all the way to the end. Seven became millionaires and two became multimillionaires. So super proud of that fact that was able to keep those relationships steady, keep them involved in the companies. And so really like that. Vendor relationships important, banking relationships. I mean, my relationships go way beyond just a traditional relationship. I'm friends with true friends with the bankers I deal with. I like them personally. And you know, I'm at a point now where I can go get a $10 million line of credit with my signature. So it's all because of those relationships.
And you talk about calculated risk too, and you being a business owner and investor in some of these brands, how did you apply that when you look at, especially at a time when the market can be volatile and you're not sure what's going to happen, how do you calculate that risk for yourself?
Yeah, you know, it's harder and harder than it used to be to do that. I have a saying where I say plan for the upside, or hope for the upside, but plan for the downside. And so, you know, you really kind of begin, for me, another term I use is ABCDE exit. I start looking backwards, and I want to know who the competition is. I want to know who the potential buyers are. I want to know, you know, what are the potential downfalls that can happen. And put structure in place to prevent that from happening, or put structure in place so that if it does happen, we pivot. You know, it would have been interesting to have owned the Orange Theory Fitness gyms when COVID hit, and what I would not have done, you know, in that particular environment. So it's really just about looking at, you know, what could happen and being realistic about things.
I want to like put yourself, I mean, in the position of a candidate as a as somebody who wants to buy a franchise, and I want you to give advice to franchise consultants out there because I work with a lot of them, and I think a lot of them struggle with understanding the mindset of the candidate. What advice do you have for people out there who are out there selling brands or a brand that's trying to grow? What do you think they need to focus on to create that brand recognition and drive interest and get people serious about moving forward and helping grow the brand?
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes I've seen franchise make is they're so consumed with selling franchises. And in my personal opinion, they should be consumed with selling territories. I really think that's so important because you have a bigger piece of the puzzle and you have someone to help you as the franchisor build brand awareness in a given market versus one little store. You know, I've got to help SendHound now build brand awareness for 25 locations. So, you know, I think that's really critical to look at that way. There's nothing wrong with a mom and pop. There's nothing wrong with buying a popsicle franchise and you're on it, run it, and that's how you make your living. That just wasn't me. I was looking at the bigger picture. And to do the bigger picture, I needed really good brand awareness, really good franchises, and really good territories. So if I had any recommendations to the broker side of it, it's, you know, find more James Webbs, And it may sound a little egotistical, which I apologize for.
No, that's
Just
okay.
find those guys that understand the concept of territory. In terms of franchisor too, I mean, I remember an example with Orange Theory where they sold area rights to a guy in one area, and he built three gyms, and then he sold 20 other gyms to other people. So he had to manage 20 franchisees inside his area. And in our area, we owned all the gyms, so we Orange Theory had to deal with one person.
Right.
And so I sort of saw that as an interesting thing about this, again, by a territory, not a franchise.
And when you say by a territory, are you talking more about like sort of the so the market, the demographics, if the economy is good, it's growing? Are you talking about all those factors?
I'm talking about all those factors and the fact that territories can be different sizes because it depends on your demographic of employee and also depends on your demographic of customer. But in this case, and I'll use SendHouse example, they draw territory with 3 mile radiuses and they want to have five stores per territory. With Orange Theory, it was, 3 mile radius and here's your territory, build as many as you want to. So again, those are my two basic experiences on that side of the fence.
And I want to try to jump out of this mode for a minute and talk about a story you told me when we talked before, which I thought was crazy. You were in the you're in the medical industry. This is before you started to get into franchising. And I remember you were talking about the MRI sales, and I think you were in, was it South America? You talk about that story. It was kind of a scary story where you had some serious things going on there. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
I will. It's kind of a fun story now. And I was certainly a little bit younger and took a little more risk. So this was in Managua, Nicaragua, and I had built an MRI center there, and it was not doing well because I learned a lot about healthcare in other countries where they don't have insurance, and the doctor really is not just the doctor; he's also the patient's banker. So was he going to let that patient spend $500 on me, or keep $500 keep spending on the doctor? So I learned a lot about that, and my final three visits there, I went there 53 times over a 3 year period trying to save the deal. And on my 51st time, there was a volcano nearby called Vulcan Messiah. And I decided to take a break one afternoon and go climb the volcano. And I did. And at the top of it was this rickety little diving board like thing somebody had built out over the lava. And I did something stupid and climbed out on the ladder. And literally over what I call the pits of hell, the sulfur was burning my lungs. And I look up and there's one Sandinista soldier. And he looks at me, and he smiles and he raises his rifle and he points it right at me. And for about 3 seconds, I thought I'm going to be the DB Cooper of the medical imaging world and I'm going to fall in this lava. Nobody's ever going to know what happened to me. But he laughed and I climbed down and I was shaking, but not completely quit. And so on my 56th second trip, I asked my attorney, who's the largest employer in Nicaragua, and he said the Sandinistas, and I kind of blew it off and said, the Sandinistas, that's the Oliver North stuff. That's not nowadays. This was in the late 90s. And he said, no, they still control the military and the police. And so I asked for a meeting with the Sandinista head of the medical division, and just straight out of a Rambo movie, drove 45 minutes out in the jungle. Come upon this rusty gate, bang on the gate. And the next thing I know, I'm thrown up against a gate. I've got a gun at my head, got a gun in my ribs. I'm surrounded by a bunch of guys hollering at me in Spanish, which I didn't understand very well. And all I could say was Chamorro, which was the name of the general. And what seemed like an eternity, which was probably 2 minutes at the most, they finally realized I was there for a good reason. And so I met with Chamorro, and unfortunately, nothing happened with the deal. And then the last visit I went, I had a bodyguard sometimes, and he handed me a sawed-off shotgun and said, there's a riot in town, you have to leave, and put me in the back of a pickup truck. And I literally went through the fire and the flames of the gunfire, ducked down the back of a pickup truck, got to the airport. And when I landed in Miami, I just said, I can't do this anymore. I got a, 3 year-old son and a baby on the way. And I called my investors up and said, hey, I'm going to sell the company. And I had already lined up a buyer that was international. And so within a month, I'd sold that company. But crazy stories like that. And it happened in Honduras. And I had some crazy ones in Trinidad. And it was just a great chapter of the book. A lot of fun to read.
So tell us about the book. What drew you to write a book? How long did it take? You know, where can people find it too?
Yeah, so I kept, because I've had an interesting life, and there's a lot of more stories in the book, and I've had some tragedy in my life that I'll share with you in a second, because I think it's important for people to understand that as well outside of the business world. But people kept saying, hey, you need to write a book, you need to write a book. And so finally, I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And started working with a gentleman going to help me as a ghostwriter. And he kind of started the book, and we spent a lot of time together just telling stories. And then he had to leave and go do another job. So I had to finish the book myself and managed to finish it. And then we decided that it would be nice to put life lessons and business lessons at the end of each chapter, and then a final chapter, kind of wrapping up all those lessons that we talked about, the relationship things and things you and I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And so it took about 18 months probably to write it. I also learned you could publish it yourself through Amazon, or you could hire a publisher. So I spent the money and hired a publishing company and a PR company, and got the book out there. It's currently on Amazon, made the bestseller list there on three different categories. It's on Books a Million, it's at Barnes and Noble. You can go to my website, jamesharoldweb.com, and get the book there. But it's a nice read, and it just really tells this country boy's journey, and why I'm absolutely the luckiest redneck you've ever met to be able to come from where I'm at to what I get to do now.
Yeah. What would you tell your younger self? I mean, if you went back and met yourself at 18 or younger high school, what would you tell yourself now? What are some of the lessons you've learned?
Yeah, you know, my children and I have a saying. It's kind of a funny story. We always just say, when I talk to them about business, they didn't teach me that at Jones County Junior College. And the truth of the matter is, in the business world, you don't learn it from college. You don't learn about the real business world. You learn it from the school of hard knocks.
Yeah.
When people talk about, you don't learn from your successes, you learn from your failures. And I add on to that, if you haven't failed at least three times, you're probably not trying hard enough.
Right.
And so a lot of what I've learned and would tell people is, well, I wish I could give you a whole story on estate planning and business structuring that they don't teach you about in school, you know, how to own nothing and use everything, and not to be exposed to death tax and all those sort of things that you learn, or the importance of asset protection. Love to teach people about that. You know, why you need an LLC, why you need an LP, why you don't need an S corp, you know, all
Right.
those sort of lessons. So those are
Yeah.
kind of things that we talk about in the book.
Yeah. Well, I think it's been a great discussion. You've got some fascinating stories and some good lessons. So work if people want to reach out to you, maybe they want to do some more podcasts with you or learn more about you. Maybe, I mean, I don't even know, maybe some speaking engagements and things. How can people reach you if they have interest to learn more?
Yeah, the best way is the website, jamesharoldweb.com, has my contact information. But I'll also tell you, I roll all my companies up into a Gmail account, so that jhweb, WEBB 933 at gmail.com. jhweb 933@gmail.com is the easiest way to reach me. And I enjoy having these discussions. I enjoy sharing my stories, and helping young entrepreneurs has been something I've been passionate about lately.
Well, thank you so much. If you want to reach out to James, you got to pick up the book, check out his website, look him up on LinkedIn. Thank you so much, James. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate having you on.
Ryan, thank you so much, buddy. Please take care.
You too. Hey, this is Ryan with the Business Stories Podcast, and I want to let you know that we are looking for sponsors for episodes. If you have a company that wants to sponsor an episode, please reach out to me at livingryan@gmail.com. And thanks again for listening.